Dakota, Bora Bora. Consider the following scenario. Jason K. is a 14-year-old homeless boy who lives in a large American city. He is shy and withdrawn, but extremely resourceful. His father was murdered when he was young. His mother is an addict. Jason takes care of himself, sleeping sometimes on the sofas at friends' apartments, but mostly on the streets. He manages to stay in school until the 9th grade. He often goes hungry. One day in 2010, he accepts an offer from a local gang to sell drugs and drops out of school. A few weeks later, the night before his 15th birthday, he is shot and killed. He was unarmed when he died. We are seeking ways to undo Jason K.'s death. Rank the following in order of their likelihood. 1. Jason's father was not murdered. 2. Jason carried a gun and was able to protect himself. 3. The U.S. federal government made it easier for homeless kids to obtain the free breakfast and lunch to which they are entitled. Jason never went hungry and remained in school. 4. A lawyer steeped in the writings of Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman took a federal government job in 2009. Drawing upon Kahneman and Tversky's work, he pushed for changes in the rules so that homeless kids no longer needed to enroll in the school meal program. Instead, they automatically received free breakfast and lunch. Jason never went hungry and remained in school. If you found number 4 more probable than number 3, you violated perhaps the simplest and most fundamental law of probability, but you're also onto something. The lawyer's name is Cass Sunstein. Among its other consequences, the work that Amos and Danny did together awakened economists and policymakers to the importance of psychology. "I became a believer," said Nobel Prize-winning economist Peter Diamond, of Danny and Amos's work. "It's all true. This stuff is not just lab stuff. It's capturing reality, and it's important to economists. And I spent years thinking of how to use it, and failing." By the early 1990s, a lot of people thought it was a good idea to bring together psychologists and economists to allow them to get to know each other better. But as it turned out, they didn't particularly want to know each other better. Economists were brash and self-assured. Psychologists were nuanced and doubtful. "Psychologists, as a rule, will only interrupt a presentation for clarification," says psychologist Dan Gilbert. "Economists will interrupt to show how smart they are. In economics, it is completely normal to be rude," says economist George Lowenstein. "We tried to create a psychology and economics seminar at Yale. We had our first meeting. The psychologist came out completely bruised. We never had a second meeting." In the early 1990s, Amos's former student, Stephen Sloman, invited an equal number of economists and psychologists to a conference in France. "And I swear to God, I spent 3/4 of my time telling the economists to shut up," said Sloman. "The problem," says Harvard social psychologist Amy Cuddy, "is that psychologists think economists are immoral, and economists think psychologists are stupid." In the academic culture war triggered by Danny and Amos's work, Amos served as a strategic advisor. At least some of his sympathies were with the economists. Amos's mind had always clashed with most of psychology. He didn't like emotion as a subject. His interest in the unconscious mind was limited to a desire to prove it didn't exist. He was like a man in stripes wandering a land settled by people dressed in plaids and polka dots. Like the economists, he preferred neat formal models to mixed chocolate boxes of psychological phenomena. Like them, he found it completely normal to be rude, and like them, he had worldly ambitions for his ideas. Economists sought influence in the arenas of finance and business and public policy. Psychologists hardly ever entered those arenas. That was about to change. Danny and Amos both saw that there was no point trying to infiltrate economics from psychology. The economists would just ignore intruders. What were needed were young economists with an interest in psychology. Almost magically, after Amos and Danny arrived in North America, they began to appear. George Lowenstein was a good example. A trained economist disillusioned by the psychological sterility of economic models, Lowenstein read Amos and Danny's work and thought, "Wait, maybe I want to be a psychologist." As he happened to be Sigmund Freud's great-grandson, this was an even more complicated than usual thought. "I had tried to escape the family's past," said Lowenstein. I realized I had never taken a single class in what really interested me. He approached Amos and asked him for advice. Should he move from economics to psychology? Amos said, "You should stay in economics. We need you there." He already knew in 1982 that he was starting a movement, and he needed people inside economics. The argument that Danny and Amos started would spill over into law and public policy. Psychology would use economics to enter these places and others. Richard Thaler, the first frustrated economist to stumble onto Danny and Amos's work and pursue its consequences for economics single-mindedly, would help to create a new field and give it the name behavioral economics. Prospect theory, scarcely cited in the first decade after its publication, would become, by 2010, the second most cited paper in all of economics. "People tried to ignore it," said Thaler. "Old economists never changed their minds." By 2016, every 10th paper published in economics would have a behavioral angle to it, which is to say, it had at least a whisper of the work of Danny and Amos. And Richard Thaler would have just stepped down from his tenure as president of the American Economic Association. Cass Sunstein had been a young law professor at the University of Chicago when he came upon Thaler's first war cry on psychology's behalf. A paper Thaler had titled in his mind, "Stupid Shit That People Do," he'd finally published as "Toward a Positive Theory of Consumer Choice." Thaler's bibliography led Sunstein directly to the article written by Danny and Amos in Science about judgment and to prospect theory. "For a lawyer, both of these were difficult," said Sunstein. "I had to read them more than once, but I remember the feeling. It was an explosion of light bulbs. You have thoughts in your mind, and you read something that immediately puts them in order, and it's electrifying." In 2009, at the invitation of President Obama, Sunstein went to work at the White House. There he oversaw the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs and made scores of small changes that had big effects on the daily lives of all Americans. The changes Sunstein made had a unifying theme. They sprang directly or indirectly from the work of Danny and Amos. You couldn't say that Danny and Amos's work led President Obama to ban federal employees from texting while driving, but it wasn't hard to draw a line from their work to that act. The federal government now became sensitive to both loss aversion and framing effects. People didn't choose between things, they chose between descriptions of things. The fuel labels on new automobiles went from listing only miles per gallon to including the number of gallons a car consumed every 100 miles. What used to be called the food pyramid became My Plate, a graphic of a dinner plate with divisions for each of the five food groups, and it was suddenly easier for Americans to see what made for a healthy diet, and so on. Sunstein argued that the government needed, alongside its Council of Economic Advisors, a Council of Psychological Advisors. He wasn't alone. By the time Sunstein left the White House in 2015, calls for a greater role for psychologists, or at any rate for psychological insight, were coming from inside governments across the world. Sunstein was particularly interested in what was now being called choice architecture. The decisions people made were driven by the way they were presented. People didn't simply know what they wanted. They took cues from their environment. They constructed their preferences, and they followed paths of least resistance, even when they paid a heavy price for it. Millions of U.S. corporate and government employees had woken up one day during the 2000s and found they no longer needed to enroll themselves in retirement plans, but instead were automatically enrolled. They probably never noticed the change, but that alone caused the participation in retirement plans to rise by roughly 30 percentage points. Such was the power of choice architecture. One tweak to the society's choice architecture made by Sunstein, once he'd gone to work in the U.S. government, was to smooth the path between homeless children and free school meals. In the school year after he left the White House, about 40% more poor kids ate free school lunches than had done so before, back when they, or some adult acting on their behalf, had to take action and make choices to get them. Even in Canada, Don Redelmeyer still heard the sound of Amos in his head. He'd been back from Stanford for several years, but Amos's voice was so clear and overpowering that it made it hard for Redelmeyer to hear his own. Redelmeyer could not pinpoint the precise moment that he sensed that his work with Amos was not all Amos's doing, that it had some Redelmeyer in it, too. His sense of his own distinct value began with a simple question about homeless people. The homeless were a notorious drag on the local healthcare system. They turned up in emergency rooms more often than they needed to. They were a drain on resources. Every nurse in Toronto knew this. If you see a homeless person wander in, hustle them out the door as fast as you can. Riddlemeyer wondered about the wisdom of that strategy, and so, in 1991, he created an experiment. He arranged for large numbers of college students who wanted to become doctors to be given hospital greens and a place to sleep near the emergency room. Their job was to serve as concierges to the homeless. When a homeless person entered the emergency room, they were to tend to his every need, fetch him juice and a sandwich, sit down and talk to him, help arrange for his medical care. The college students worked for free. They loved it. They got to pretend to be doctors, but they serviced only half of the homeless people who entered the hospital. The other half received the usual curt and dismissive service from the nursing staff. Riddlemeyer then tracked the subsequent use of the Toronto healthcare system by all the homeless people who had visited his hospital. Unsurprisingly, the group that received the gold-plated concierge service tended to return slightly more often to the hospital where they had received it than the unlucky group. The surprise was that their use of the Greater Toronto healthcare system declined. When homeless people felt taken care of by a hospital, they didn't look for other hospitals that might take care of them. The homeless said, "That was the best that could be done for me." The entire Toronto healthcare system had been paying a price for its attitude to the homeless. A part of good science is to see what everyone else can see, but think what no one else has ever said. Amos had said that to him, and it had stuck in Riddlemeyer's mind. By the mid-1990s, in startling ways, Riddlemeyer was taking what everyone could see and thinking to say what no one had ever said. For instance, one day he had a phone call from an AIDS patient who was suffering side effects of medication. In the middle of the conversation, the patient cut him off and said, "I'm sorry, Dr. Riddlemeyer, I have to go. I just had an accident." The guy had been talking to him on a cell phone while driving. Riddlemeyer wondered, did talking on a cell phone while driving increase the risk of an accident? In 1993, he and Cornell statistician Robert Tibshirani created a complicated study to answer the question. The paper they wrote in 1997 proved that talking on a cell phone while driving was as dangerous as driving with a blood alcohol level at the legal limit. A driver talking on a cell phone was four times as likely as a driver who wasn't to be involved in a crash, whether or not he held the phone in his hands. That paper, the first to establish rigorously the connection between cell phones and car accidents, spurred calls for regulation around the world. It would take another, even more complicated study to determine just how many thousands of lives it saved. The study also piqued Riddlemeyer's interest in what happened inside the mind of a person behind the wheel of a car. The doctors in the Sunnybrook Trauma Center assumed that their jobs began when the human beings mangled on nearby Highway 401 arrived in the emergency room. Riddlemeyer thought it was insane for medicine not to attack the problem at its source. 1.2 million people on the planet died every year in car accidents, and multiples of that were maimed for life. 1.2 million deaths a year worldwide, said Riddlemeyer. One Japanese tsunami every day. Pretty impressive for a cause of death that was unheard of 100 years ago. When exercised behind the wheel of a car, human judgment had irreparable consequences. That idea now fascinated Riddlemeyer. The brain is limited. There are gaps in our attention. The mind contrives to make those gaps invisible to us. We think we know things we don't. We think we are safe when we are not. For Amos, it was one of the core lessons, said Riddlemeyer. It's not that people think they are perfect. No, no, they can make mistakes. It's that they don't appreciate the extent to which they are fallible. I've had 3 or 4 drinks. I might be 5% off my game. No, you are actually 30% off your game. This is the mismatch that leads to 10,000 fatal accidents in the United States every year. It is sometimes easier to make the world a better place than to prove you have made the world a better place. Amos had said that, too. Amos gave everyone permission to accept human error, said Riddlemeyer. That was how Amos made the world a better place, though it was impossible to prove. The spirit of Amos was now present in everything Riddlemeyer did. It was present in his article about the dangers of driving while speaking on a cell phone, which Amos had read and commented upon. That was the article Redemeyer was working on when the call came with the news that Amos had died.